The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Please note, due to a health emergency, there is a 1 to 2 minute silent interlude during the final 3 minutes of this talk.
So an important part of Buddhist spiritual life is contemplation or reflection, to actually think about particular themes. And in the Zen tradition, they have koans, which are a little bit enigmatic kind of statements that people grapple with for a long time. In our tradition, we have more kind of simple, straightforward themes that are not so mysterious, but can be equally challenging, maybe mysterious for us to learn how to work with in a deep way. And the theme that I'd like to bring up for contemplation today, suggested maybe you take it on for this week, is that of equanimity. Equanimity is considered the crown jewel of the spiritual qualities, spiritual virtues, inner capacities that come with Buddhist practice. And once it's strongly developed, it's one of the most sublime and beautiful states, emotions, mental qualities that a person can experience. Until it's well developed, some people are turned off by the idea of equanimity because it can appear to be indifference and some kind of aloofness or indifference. But that's certainly not what we're talking about when we talk about equanimity. Equanimity is an imperturbability of the mind. The mind is not shaken or pushed around by the experience of life. It's where the mind's peace, subtleness, is kept intact, regardless of what goes on around us. So there's an evenness of mind, a balance of mind, a centeredness of mind, a non-reactivity of mind that comes with equanimity. But to define it as the absence of reactivity doesn't quite do it justice, because it comes with a very palpable, tangible quality, feeling in the mind of a great pervasive peace, of well-being, of kind of like calm. It's a wonderful thing. So equanimity is considered the crown jewel of Buddhist practice, because it's when equanimity is quite strong, it's the kind of the last door, or the last kind of stage before the mind can get liberated. That liberation in Buddhism, classically, is built on a strong foundation of equanimity, this very strong balance of mind. As long as the mind is reacting to things, it's very hard for the mind to let go of its clinging, because reactivity often comes with being concerned with our attachments and clingings and fears and everything. But we no longer are caught up in fears, reactions, clinging, attachments. Then the mind has a kind of stableness and steadiness and ease with which it's a lot easier then to kind of let go of the last clingings that hold us in place. So it's a crown jewel because it feels so good. It's such a wonderful, sublime experience. And also because it's the stepping stone to the last kind of stage of practice, which is liberation. It's also a very useful quality to develop in life, and much short of liberation. Cultivating equanimity helps us go through life with much more ease and can avoid a lot of problems. It's been said that it can take 20 years or years to develop a really good friendship, and it can take an instant to ruin it when we act in some reactive, impulsive way because we're caught by the situation. And then we regret what we've done. We have equanimity, but what goes on around us, then we're less likely to react impulsively to what's happening, but rather be able to tap into a wise understanding of what goes on. The idea of going from young adults sitting tonight to aging workshop next Saturday points to this trajectory, this arc, that we people have if they have a long life, the arc people have in their life, of going from often the energy and delight of being young to the fading away that happens as we get older, the decay of age. And not just flowers that decay, but it's also old people. We do a disservice, I think, to the world by always depicting Buddha, the Buddha statues, in a kind of as a young man. You could probably usually depict him in the night of his enlightenment when he was 36, and usually sits very straight, upright, he has no wrinkles, there should be, I think, in order to do justice to this life that we live in, there should also be statues of him as an old man, which I've never seen. There's a depiction, there's a story, he describes himself in one of the suttas as being having a bent back and a wrinkled face. And we don't think of your wonderful founder of your religion as being all bent over and wrinkled. But, you know, he died when he was 80, 81. And probably looked quite old and back then. I imagine he was toothless. You know, who knows, you know. They didn't have dentists back then. But they didn't have a lot of sugar either. Some years ago I was visiting with Blanche Hartman, who was she's taught here. She's in her 80s. She's a wonderful Zen teacher, abbot of Zen Center. And she asked me how I was, and I told her that there was starting to be some health signs of old age, sickness, and decay going on for me. And she lit up. And she said, yes, if you're lucky enough, that's what happens. If you're lucky enough, that's what happens. Lucky enough to live that long, that's what happens. What do you expect? When you see this arc, you know, with young kids, you see them develop and grow, and you get kind of excited and happy to see the stages of growth sometimes. And then you get to a certain point in that arc where it goes in the other direction, if you're lucky enough. And steadily to watch it, your capacities and abilities and health kind of begin to decline. And some of us see it in our parents. And, you know, some people have nursed their parents into old age. Some parents have died. But you can sometimes watch the decay of parents if you're lucky enough to have parents live to an old age, perhaps. And it can be quite challenging for someone you care for so much about and someone for whom has been so important for you and perhaps has been a kind of a stable source of security, a refuge, begin to decay and not be able to have that ability anymore. So how do we have equanimity in the face of some of the great challenges that exist in this life? How do we have equanimity? The shorthand for these challenges in Buddhism is sickness, old age, and death. But it includes a lot of different things. Is it desirable to have equanimity in the face of these huge challenges that we have? Some people feel that it's very important to be agitated. They wouldn't say it that way. They would, you know, stand up and say, it's important, everybody should be agitated. But there's sometimes a deep belief in the value of worry, agitation, fear. I know that in some families, occasionally, that the way that people show love and care is if they worry. And if you don't worry, then you don't have any other way of showing that you're really connected and care and involved. And so you have to worry properly. And the better you worry, you know, the better you kind of show that you're connected. And if you're equanimous, then somehow, you know, it can be seen as being not caring. Oh, apologize if I jump around a little bit. Some years ago, there was a man who came to IMC. He was an elderly man. He came for a few years. And then he came to me one day and said, "My kids are worried about me. Are you okay, Dad?" And because I spent my whole life being anxious. And after a few years at IMC of meditating, I stopped being anxious. And they thought something was really wrong with me. Because it wasn't the old dad, you know. There must be signs of dementia or something. So to be agitated also is various ways of being agitated. Is also people believe in it because sometimes it's a way of getting attention. If we're kind of worked up and agitated, then people notice us more and will maybe more likely take care of us. If we stay equanimous and peaceful in the midst of our difficulties, then is anybody going to care? Only if we get excited will people care. Or there can be fear that sets in motion. Some people believe in fear a lot. And they believe that somehow, most anxiety is fear that's believed about imaginary things. Some people make the distinction between anxiety and fear, and that fear is for things that are real, and anxiety are things that are imaginary. Because they haven't happened yet, they're imagining into the future what might happen. So some of you probably believe in anxiety. Otherwise, why would you be anxious? So equanimity challenges some deep beliefs we have about how we think we're supposed to function in this life. A friend of mine who was a hospice nurse told me once that at some point in working with families of a patient in the hospice, she would tell the family, from now on, there's no more crisis. So now, whatever happens now is not a crisis. So you can imagine, someone's come close to death. They can have a heart attack. All kinds of things can happen. But she said, at this point, there's no more crisis. Is it possible to have the equanimity, the non-reactivity, to allow nature to take its course after a certain point? And you realize it's hopeless, this is where it's going. And okay, and what does it take, to stop getting anxious, stop running around to the doctors and grabbing them by the throat and say, you have to do something for my loved one. They can't be in distress anymore. Is it appropriate at some point to let nature take its course? And is it appropriate to not get worked up? Here's a worked up story that maybe I've told this before, but there was a woman who came, I knew her mostly on retreats, and she had come to many retreats that I taught. At some point, she had breast cancer, and she worked really hard to overcome the cancer. And so she lived much longer than people expected. But she kept, but she still had the cancer and she kept fighting it with all her might, partly because she had a young daughter. And when her daughter was about 10 years old, she came to me and said, she came to retreat again and said, there's not much hope anymore. I'm going to die. This is pretty much where it's going. I don't even know how long now, but that's where it's, I've done everything I can. And she was really angry and really afraid. A lot of it because of her daughter. And so I told this mother, I said, this is sad. I'm sorry for you. It's difficult for the daughter. But one of the most, how you die is going to be one of the most significant influences on your daughter's life, the rest of her life. If you die angry and afraid, it's going to set the course of her life in some big way. If you can die at peace, it's going to create a very different way for her to address her life and go forward here. So some months later, 6 months or so, I heard from the father that in fact she had died. And she had died at home peacefully. And when both the daughter and the husband were there, she died peacefully. And when the mother died, they went out in the garden and got a flower and came back and put the flower on the mother's chest. So when is it best to be peaceful? When is it best to be equanimous? When is the best thing we do to someone, to support other people and support ourselves, not to get worked up, not to get agitated, but rather to stay more peaceful? I think one of the interesting things to reflect on in contemplating equanimity and the value of it and how to, what it's about, is to use kind of a crude economic terms, to do a cost-benefit analysis on anxiety and agitation. Is it really to your benefit to get agitated? So rather than say, oh, you should be equanimous, let's turn it upside down and say, should you get agitated? Should you get anxious? Should you get angry? Is this really beneficial and useful to do that? And if you really are mindful of how agitation, how fear, anxiety, distress, how that impacts us, how that affects us, chances are that you'll begin getting disenchanted, disillusioned with the value and importance of those kinds of activities. Many people have come to me, and it's always about anger, not anything else, but anger. They come to say, you know, now that I'm being mindful, I see how painful anger is for me. I don't think it's useful to be angry anymore. I'm causing myself more harm than that enemy of mine. and so they kind of give up their anger because they just see it's just, it hurts too much. Some of you probably are protesting now in your mind. You can say, well, wait a minute. Anger, fear, agitation, all these things, I don't have any control over those. Those just kind of happen. I'm just doing my life, I'm minding my own business. And then suddenly I get overwhelmed. This I get visited, I get taken over. I'm not responsible. I'm not the one who's doing it. It just happens. And now you're telling me I have to take responsibility? Yep. That's what we're asked to do in Buddhist practice, is to use the capacity for mindfulness to look carefully and see what goes on in our minds and our hearts, and to see how things come into play, how our mind picks up its ideas, its reactions, its feelings and thoughts, and gets involved and acts them out. So when I started doing meditation practice, it was in the Zen tradition. And one of the values of Zen training and the strictness and discipline of Zen is when you're in the Zendo meditating, you're expected not to move for the period of meditation. Here at IMC, you can move if you want. And I think it's better actually to err on the side of being lax than to err on the side of being strict like they are at Zen. But it's also great to have discipline. It's a great training. And I benefited a lot from it. So what it meant was that for years, for endless hours, weeks, months on end sometimes, of practice, I would be sitting upright and would not move physically, no matter what was going on with my emotions, no matter what was going on with my thoughts, and no matter what was going on physically. And so because of how disciplined Zen is, it's not uncommon for Zen students to have a lot of physical pain when they sit. And I sat with a lot of pain. So what does it take to sit and not react physically to strong pain? What does it take to not react physically to strong emotional surges that come through us? And often, you know, if you feel suddenly really sad or really, some people can slump or depressed, they slump and lean over or there's all kinds of things we do with our posture. But in the Zendo, you can't succumb to those postural being influenced by our emotions. You have to kind of just stay sitting there. And so all these thoughts can occur. Thoughts like, maybe I should go to the movies instead. I say that because I had a friend who sat at Sesshin, a 7-day retreat, Zen retreat, and he told me later, oh, in the middle of the third day, I left and went to the movies. Once at Spirit Rock, I was teaching their retreat, and this guy came in for an interview, and he said, oh, this is great being on retreat, it's wonderful. And yesterday afternoon, I went down the street to the golf course. And maybe he hadn't understood the program. So all kinds of ideas can come up, desires can come up, strong desires can come for something else, strong aversions can come up. And in the Zen training, you're told just to sit still and not move. And it becomes a training in non-reactivity. And it takes a lot of mindfulness, a lot of self-awareness to watch oneself and watch the tendency to react and not give into it. So at least physically, it starts physically, but it translates to a more mental capacity, ability, not to react or pick up or be pushed around by all the different forces within us. And for me, the beginning of that training was very physical. It wasn't mental. It was a physicality of not moving during meditation. Very powerful training. And a lot of beliefs, strong ideas, strong attachments will come up that say, you can't do this. It's not okay to sit still with this. And itches are great. No one has died in meditation yet from an itch. So it's a wonderful place to train in equanimity and non-reactivity. Okay, you know, it can feel awful. It feels like you feel desperate. It can feel like I am going to die. I'm going to scream. But you know you're not going to. You have to use remember your wisdom. And then you think, well, this is not worth it. I came to get calm and settled and peaceful and have, and this, you know, this is just, you know, awful. You know, and maybe I'll never meditate again. But if you understand that meditation is much more than becoming calm, it's also developing inner strengths. And one of the strengths is one of non-reactivity, of equanimity. And so the itch gives you an opportunity to struggle with yourself, to struggle against the forces inside of you that want to bolt, that want to scratch, that want to scream, that want to do whatever, that want to argue with the Buddha. You know, it's, meditation is ridiculous. To sit here and have an itch is just, you know, the worst thing. And you know, there's all these forces inside of us start kicking into gear. And to train in not buying into any of them, to train to sit still and not move. At the end of the sitting, you might be more agitated than you were when you started a situation like that. But you might be a lot stronger as well. We don't measure the progress of spirituality by, you know, how calm you always get, but also by the strength of your capacity to sit still with what's here. There are times when a successful meditation session is measured only by the fact that you didn't leave your cushion. Sometimes meditation is like being riding on a wild bronco, because the inner forces are that strong. The fact that you didn't get up and leave, that's successful when the forces are that strong. It's very important not to measure a success in meditation by calm, deep stillness. Success in meditation has a lot to do with meeting successfully what is presented to you. Not your inner state, but rather how you meet your inner state. So to train in meditation, what part of the training in meditation is to train in non-reactivity. And something like an itch is a wonderful training for that. So within reason, physical pain is a good thing for that. Emotional challenges, strong emotions is a great training for that. I've sat in the Zendo meditation hall, and I don't want to tell you the full stories. Maybe you'll be a little bit generous to me when I tell you the story. Don't assume the worst of me. But I've sat in the Zendo, and all I could do was not slug the person next to me. And so that was a training in equanimity or non-reactivity. I had good cause. But I sat still. And, you know, and there was part of that training. So meditation is a preeminent place to train and develop our capacity to be non-reactive. And we certainly avoid getting into trouble. I know that if I'd slugged the guy, next to me, there were probably 10 people who would have jumped me. Literally, you know, it probably would have been very dangerous for me to have done that. So I saved myself a lot of problems and probably a visit to the hospital. And but you know, you can save yourself a lot of smaller problems too, just simple non-reactivity. And then the challenge is how to be non-reactive and still be honest with who we are. Some people will practice non-reactivity. Some people are really good at it, and they hide behind a wall of non-reactivity, and you don't know what's going on with them. They're very private, they hide, they don't want people to know. And so that's not, you know, that's not real equanimity in Buddhism. That's hiding, which is a kind of pulling back. So how to be honest while being equanimous as well? That's part of the contemplation and reflection for you to think about. How to be honest to yourself. Part of the solution, of course, is to be mindful. To be really mindful and honest with what's going on. How to be non-reactive and honest about what's happening is a very important part of this training that we're doing here. So is it worthwhile to get agitated? Is it worthwhile to get distressed? Is it worthwhile to get afraid? Is it worthwhile to get angry? There are a number of ways of answering that question for yourself, to do the cost-benefit analysis. But as an inner life gets cultivated, as meditation practice, for example, deepens, then you start having a different reference point for doing that cost-benefit analysis. If you're always agitated, being a little bit more agitated, it doesn't matter that much. But if you're really peaceful, then that level of agitation that you didn't mind before stands in big contrast. It's a huge difference between it. So someone whose baseline is already agitated is not going to see much difference. But someone's baseline is in a deep inner sense of well-being, of peace, of stillness or quiet or love or some kind of well-being, then there's a bigger difference. And you might be more interested in safeguarding that deep sense of inner well-being. And you might see more clearly that it's not worth losing that well-being no matter what's happening around you. And I've been in situations where I've grappled a little bit with this question, because there have been people that I've known who have been in dire circumstance, difficult situations. I've done whatever I could think of to try to help and support them. So I wasn't just sitting back and being equanimous, you know, let them kind of do what they're doing. I was involved. But I watched, you know, should I be distressed? Should I get anxious or not? And as I grappled with that issue, I could see very clearly that it just wasn't worth losing the inner sense of well-being that I have for the sake of the situation here. It didn't help. It wouldn't help me take care of it better. In fact, I think it may help me take care of it worse, because if I'm agitated and distressed and anxious, then I don't think very clearly. And I offer a different kind of presence to other people. If I'm equanimous, there's also a powerful lesson equanimity gives to others. And that is that they also have to take responsibility for themselves. You can still help and do all kinds of things, but with equanimity, you're less likely to be emotionally entangled with the other person. And we do other people a big favor by not getting emotionally entangled with them. It can be a challenge for them. It can be emotionally, you know, that they feel that love and connected, it requires you to be entangled with them. But if we don't get entangled with them, then it allows them to see their own tendency to entanglement And hopefully they can take responsibility for it. Certainly we don't want to take, I don't think it's healthy for us to take responsibility for other people's entanglements. One of the ways equanimity is cultivated in Buddhism is to reflect that each person is the heir to their own karma. Each people, what they experience, their happiness and suffering, has a lot to do with the choices they've made. And even though I might wish the person well and want to support the person the best I can, I can't undo their karma. I can't undo the choices they have made and they are making. And we do people, I believe we do people a favor to leave people alone in the world of their karma and choices. We can give advice, we can be supportive, we can offer them love, but there's a way of kind of where our equanimity, where we don't get kind of excited and worked up, offers something to them that that is much more profound than is offered if we get emotionally, anxiously tied up with them. So my hope is that your mindfulness practice, both in meditation and in daily life, gives you some perspective and self-understanding that encourages you to question the kinds of reactions that you have within, the emotional, mental, and even physical reactivities that occur with events around you. And you begin questioning that movement, the agitation of the mind, the excitement of the mind that happens. And don't take it for granted that it has to be that way. Perhaps it's something you can let go of. Perhaps it's something you don't have to buy into. Perhaps you can hold your balance independent of these things. There can be strong emotions washing through, and you can hold your ground with them. Stay grounded, stay stabilized. And you know, let these powerful waves come through, but don't give in to them. Don't succumb to them. As we learn, and then in meditation as well, to think of meditation in part as a training area to cultivate this very significant form of non-reactivity. To allow things, all kinds of things can happen. You should meditate, but learn how not to react to it. Just be with it, be with it, be with it. And then, yeah. Oh, we need some help out there?
Yes.
Oh, we need a doctor. Is there a doctor in the house?
Yes.
And does someone have a phone?
Yes.
Can you call 911? There's a doctor out there. There's a doctor there. Yeah, Peter's calling the phone. And if everybody can sit quietly for a moment, and this is a time for... So Thea is a doctor, and maybe he has a little seizure, but he says he's fine. Hear the laughter. but we're going to have the ambulance come and check him. So I think what we should do is quietly kind of mostly vacate, and so they can come in and take care of him. If so maybe not a lot of people should go out that way, but we can go out this way here, just kind of go around and do it quietly. And also if some of you are going to stay for the meeting with Jack, that'll happen also in the conference room. And as we, certainly this is a time for a powerful lesson, what I was talking about today. But it isn't just a time for equanimity, but also for our loving kindness and our compassion. And there's here people taking care of him, and we'll offer as much care as we can. And for you to hold him in your good thoughts. He's been a volunteer and helper here for a long time. He lives across the street. And we'll do our best to care for him. So, thank you all.
Please note that the individual that experienced the health issues is fine. The individual went to the hospital, was checked out, and got a clean bill of health. So, not to worry.